Everybody in with some of that idea, and I think we can get the doors closed a little bit so it's not too loud out in the hallway. But I am going to ask you guys to settle in for this discussion because I know this is a hot topic for everybody. We're talking about the new sports video experience, and we have a great panel to talk about that. So if I haven't met you, my name is Eric Johnson. I'm the director of the Streaming Video Tech Pod. I've worked in sports, news, media, and entertainment for almost 20 years. A lot of these folks I have worked with in the past. So I'm honored to be here today to discuss this important topic. So what we're going to talk about in this session is sports content and the future of the fan experience. So what I want to first do is introduce our panelists. I'm going to give you a few data points, some of the topics that we're going to get to discuss, and then I'll come back and ask all of you guys to introduce yourself. So starting from my left to right, we have Michelle Gamble, who is the Director of Media and Entertainment at the Los Angeles Rams. John Kozner is here, who is the President of Kozner Media. Mike Lee is the Senior Vice President of Global Rights and Acquisitions at Flow Sports. Megan Leininger is here. She is the Vice President of Media and Entertainment and Partnerships at Endeavor Streaming. And then Marty Roberts is also here. He is the Senior Vice President of Product Strategy and Marketing at Brightco. So give them a quick round of applause. While I sort of settle in here, we start talking about sports and sports media rights and everything going on in the landscape. So it seems today that online streaming services are acquiring sports media rights and view sports content as the next growth sector in sports streaming. So when we think about that, TV revenue is being raised by selling their broadcast rights to the highest bidders. Sports content is utilizing the network broadcasters and live streaming services to attract new subscribers. Max, Paramount, Apple TV Plus, and Amazon Prime Video are all expanding their exclusive sports content to bolster their streaming portfolios. Revenue from OTT sports streaming services, according to our Parks Associates forecast, this year is $15.3 billion and will increase to about $22 billion by 2017. And just yesterday, Netflix, I'm sure we all saw the news or heard the news, finally entered into the sports content arena by announcing a live exclusive golf tournament featuring PGA Tour players playing against Formula One golf players. And that just aired yesterday. I'm not sure that the reports are back in yet as to how successful or not successful that was, but certainly we're seeing that these streaming services are all jumping in. So entertainment media services and tech media giants who have sports rely on sports content to not only increase their subscriber numbers, but also generate advertising revenue. However, one of the challenges of streaming services is convincing sports fans that the content is actually worth the price of the subscription. So research by our Parks Associates reveals that just 24% of sports enthusiasts subscribe to a service solely to view a specific event. So that indicates that for many sports fans, to be enticed to subscribe to a service, there needs to be more than just a single exclusive event like the Netflix event. So the hope is that Netflix continues to produce live sporting content as they did the other day. So with that in mind, and to give you an overview of this session, we're going to focus on what's happening in the sports media rights landscape, the fragmented fan experience that's taking place, and how to make it better. So what is that future of sports streaming? So I'd like to take a moment from each of you to briefly introduce yourself. Let's see if I got the slides in order. Yep, so Michelle Gamble, why don't we start with you? Tell us a little bit about what you do and who you work for.
Yes, thank you, Eric, for having us, for having me. Hello, everyone. Nice to see you this morning. So as Eric mentioned, I'm the Director of Media Entertainment. This is for the LA Rams. This is my second season with the Rams. Don't come after me after this session. I work on the business side, not the football side, which sadly not having the best season. But we speak a little bit once, you know, once we get through, right? We have an amazing stadium at SoFi. I was lucky enough. I was unfortunate to not have been a part of the team when we won the Super Bowl, but was lucky enough to join right after the Super Bowl. And it was the first year that we really opened up SoFi to the Bengals, right? So the stadium opened, attendance was not at full capacity because of COVID, and it wasn't really until post-Super Bowl, I mean, naturally we had the big game and it was at capacity, but last season was really when we opened broadly, and very exciting to talk about just the video capabilities that we've brought into the stadium, and hopefully some of you have been to the stadium.
Are you giving out free tickets?
We have a game this coming Sunday, so whoever's staying in town, highly recommend that you check out.
Well, thank you for being here. Next up, John Kozner, president of Kozner Media.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Eric, thank you. Thank you to Parks for organizing this. So my background is all in sports media and digital sports media. For 15 years, I ran that for ESPN. So that was ESPN.com, the app, fantasy games, streaming, direct-to-consumer, podcasting. If you love the sort of intersection of sports and technology, and I think Eric will attest, there are a few places that were better to be there than ESPN at that time. Earlier in my career, I ran broadcasting at the NBA during the Dream Team era. I've also worked at NBC Sports and CBS Sports. I left ESPN in June of 17, and because I'm a glutton for punishment, I reunited with the late NBA Commissioner David Stern, and we created a portfolio of sports tech companies that we call micromanagement ventures, which if you knew David, you'd appreciate the humor. Some of those companies include WSC Sports, Whoop, Overtime, LiveLike. And today I continue to invest and advise sports tech startups. I also do some consulting with the United States Olympic and Paralympic Committee, among other companies. I do expert witness work, and for those of you who are having trouble sleeping, I am a regular columnist for the Sports Business Journal. So thank you, and look forward to
your appreciate the humor. We will all fall asleep tonight reading your article. Next up, Mike Lee, tell us a little bit about New York.
Pleased to be here. Nice to meet you all, and a great panel to be on. Flow Sports represents a slightly different sector in the sports media ecosystem. We really have limited to no aspirations of competing with the likes of ESPN on tier one media rights. We see a robust opportunity for the long tail in sports media. We have partnerships with huge brands like NASCAR, the Tour de France, the NCAA, the Big East Conference, and USA Wrestling, and more. But for us, in this increasingly fragmented world that you spoke of earlier, we see robust opportunity for building ecosystems in sport, building economies in sports that are traditionally underserved, and then in our space in particular, doing it profitably. I think we'll talk a lot about the struggle to reach profits in direct-to-consumer live sports. Flow has done that effectively, and we've done it in non-traditional ways, creating context, emotional interactions, and in addition to the live distribution.
Awesome. Well, thank you for being here. And I actually think Marty is next. So I didn't organize the seating appropriately, apparently.
No worries. So I'm Marty Roberts. I run product strategy and marketing for Brightco. Brightco is one of the original video platforms that's out in the space. Coming up on 20 years now, actually, with the company. We work with all kinds of different types of sports customers. Everywhere from broadcasters that have sports rights, like the Women's World Cup, or the World Cup, or you name it, the Olympics, we service those, reaching millions of concurrent viewers and streaming. We work with a lot of different leagues, like NHL, MLS, the Premier League, really on a lot of around fan engagement, and then it goes down from there. Individual sports teams, like in Man City. I was just this summer meeting with horse racing in Australia, horse trials, the horse buggies, really innovative
racing for a minute. Are we going to talk about buggy racing? Is that on your agenda?
It is compelling, huh? So, yes.
And last but not least, Megan Wagner, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Yeah, so Megan Wagner, I represent Endeavor Streaming, which is a part of the wider Endeavor company, and we are the streaming technology and strategy arm of the company. So we work with direct-to-consumer streaming solutions for the biggest names in sports globally. We also have our own O&O, so we own WWE, UFC, PBR, which is professional bull riding, so that might be right along with those buggies. We kind of cross the gamut in terms of that with sports. So happy to be here.
Awesome. Well, thank you all for being here. So I think what I wanted to do is sort of set the landscape and sort of thinking about understanding what's happening in sports media with the leagues and the broadcast partners. I thought I would start with John and ask you to give us sort of an overview of what you see is happening in the landscape right now with sports media and sports broadcast.
Well, we're definitely in transition. It's almost like the music industry. For my entire career, the pay television bundle has been the bank for sports. You know, at its heyday, 90% of Americans subscribed. Non-sports fans basically subsidized sports fans. So if your grandmother didn't watch ESPN, she was still paying several dollars every month out of her bill. The agreements that viewers would sign were annual or multi-annual. So there was a steady stream of revenue that would come into the cable operator that would then be shared with pay TV networks like ESPN and Turner and Fox Sports. And we would then take those guaranteed sums and go to rights holders like the NFL and write big checks. And the rights holders would share approximately half of that money with their players. And for years, it was the best of all financial models if you worked in sports. And I remember being in a staff meeting at ESPN about 10 years ago, and we were having a presentation about Netflix. And Netflix had just started streaming, and they were charging about $8 a month. And for the first time, you could get a product that was kind of like television. It didn't have any sports, but it cost, you know, it didn't cost a tenth of what the bundle cost, but it was in that range. And I had this kind of out of body experience that we were about to see real change. And of course, it's taken a while, but that's what's happened. And the pay TV business has seen accelerating losses. I believe approximately 12% decline in video subs among the major MVPDs this year. That goes right to the bottom line of every sports TV network that's trying to buy sports rights. All of them have gotten into streaming, but as many of you know, it's not the same business. Close, you also have really deep-pocketed competitors like the tech platforms. You know, and even Netflix yesterday appears to get in. So we're in a bunch of transition, and it's not totally clear where it's going to go. And one thing I'll say is sports itself has never been more valuable than it is today. And I would just add, when you think about advertising, sports is a perfect venue for advertising because it's live. You have to watch it live. The athletes have to rest. So there are natural places to put advertising in. Simultaneously, advertising has been degraded by the growth of streaming, where it's seen as like a less than experience. Or, okay, you can buy the cheaper package that has advertising. Sports is the only one that will offer you everyone's attention live, and that's only going to grow as you move into the future.
So you're talking about the impact on advertising that sports has, right?
I think it's going to be, it's not part of the mix, it's going to drive advertising.
So, Marty, question for you then. When you think about the Apple, Netflix, Amazon Primes of the world that are securing up sports media rights, is it because of the advertising dollars? What is the reason that you think the big tech giants are looking at sports content?
Yeah, you know, in our conversations, what we typically find is the order of priority is audience acquisition. So, you know, there's a good demographic match between what Apple TV wants to acquire its customers and the MLS. And so they can go out. The second then is once they have them in, it's that retention, right? So on these VOD platforms, you're never more at risk to churn out after you finish your favorite show. And so the question then is, well, we'll keep coming back next week and next week, and that's going to be that next event that's out there today. And so making sure that happens. And then it is creating this really interesting platform for advertising to come along with it. And so it's always a balance of, you know, how do I reach a big enough audience? And at the same time, how do I balance that relative to so that fan engagement, reaching the biggest audience while maximizing revenues, given that the cable bundle isn't that guaranteed revenue stream anymore? How are we going to make that all back up? And so is the pie just going to get a little bit smaller because of it?
Megan, you come from clearly a streaming product or platform. Maybe this is more of an opinion question, but do we think that traditional cable providers are in trouble?
Well, I think that when we look at sports specifically, it's really no longer an either-or kind of proposition. So we've got teams and leagues that, you know, are used to those, you know, cable type of paychecks. And so I think that what we've seen, at least at Endeavor Streaming, is that there is an approach for both the linear and the streaming side, and being able to incorporate that in has been successful in sometimes recouping some of that loss in terms of the financials, but also in building loyalty with their, you know, fan base.
So thinking about fan bases, that's a good lead into my next question. I want to ask you, how are you leveraging your experiences to create a better fan experience, right? How are you leveraging the assets that you have, that you can control? And when you think about that from your perspective, not only in the stadium, but the platforms that you have access to and how consumers are engaging with your product.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the fan experience is everything, right? Fandom is everything. And I will say we're, you know, we're in a little bit of a tougher spot, in my opinion, based on the fact that LA based, went to St. Louis, then back to LA. So, and then by virtue of being in LA, and for those that are LA natives as myself, you know there are a lot of people in LA not from LA. So, and if you've been to a Rams game, you see that, right? And people travel. But the beauty, in my opinion, is we do have this beautiful stadium that we opened, as I mentioned, just a few years ago, and that's really where we are cementing or have cemented a beautiful structure, amazing structure for our fans to come to obviously celebrate our team. And we created a one-of-a-kind video board where we are working with partners. I work very closely with our game programming team. I'm literally heading to the stadium right after this to test for this coming weekend, right? Because it is so important that we are capturing our fans that are there to watch a game, but naturally working in with brands, right, on promotion, on how to leverage the assets that we have in stadium, and then how does that amplify into social? How do we touch our audiences throughout different touch points? Because we know that not all the fans are going to be at the stadium on Sunday. It's not easy, but we definitely have, you know, the team in place that is doing a great job, and I think it just goes back to, you know, what we're doing with partners from a fan engagement standpoint has been incredible. We're the only stadium and the first NFL team to bridge a partnership with Snapchat, where we have integrated their Snap camera into our live in-game feed. So I will say, when most of us are very familiar with stadiums and arenas and the kiss cam and fun features that fans love, This brings a very different, innovative, and immersive element to the game. And last year we partnered with Disney, where we turned fans into Navis for Avatar, for the release of Avatar. This year we have a very fun experience with Princess Cruises. So yeah, we're looking at innovation, you know, bringing innovation to the stadium that we can extend to partners.
So when you think about fan engagement or the, you know, experience, clearly a lot of that rides on if the team does well, right? You're going to have a larger fan base. People are going to, you know, gather around and support the team more. But what sort of KPIs or metrics are you looking at to sort of measure your success?
Well, it's the fan growth, right? I mean, that's the main priority. That's the number one goal, is reaching those fans. And, you know, right now, it's how do we reach the younger fans? And so I think a big part of, as I mentioned, what we're doing in stadium with the partnership with Snapchat and social obviously is a big part of that, and how do we continue to message the younger demographics that when we look at the NFL's median age is over 50 years old, right? That's what, you know, a lot of people can say that's a problem, right? And that's a problem that we take very seriously, obviously being in one of the biggest markets, and so that's the main priority for us.
So, Mike, you're in a unique position when I think about your product and your content, right? You are creating a, I don't know what you call it, almost a community for your fans and the way you serve your fans, right? So what does your product or your experience offer on, say, the off days or maybe when you don't have the live event?
So philosophically, the thing that I'm hearing in commonality is that video, particularly in sports, is increasingly commoditized. The ability to get a live product out of a venue or out of a building is no longer rocket science and limited to a broadcast television network or an ESPN. You're seeing it at the youngest of youth levels, the ability to get a semi-quality footage out the door. So for Flow, we have to figure out how to build community and create engaging customers. We talked about maintaining subscribers for a long period of time. It's absolutely essential for us to create a platform that fans love. And so no longer is it acceptable for fans to dish out hard-earned money in order to come and go on a pay-per-view basis or to watch an event and then leave. They need to be surprised and delighted on a daily basis if you want to retain that customer for any length of period. So when we do it right, we are programming our channels, and we're verticalized by sport. You know, Flow Racing is our motorsports channel, Flow Wrestling is our wrestling channel, and so forth and so on. We have 20 of them. When we're doing it right, there is something to come and capture, something new, either a live event, a podcast, highlight footage, interviews, editorial content. Every single day we're programming our channels so that there is reason to engage, there's reason to be delighted. And then we use both free and paid models in order to create that context and that stickiness. I think the challenge for all entertainment and all media, and certainly in sports, is the sticky factor. You have to create fandom. You have to convert casual fans into avid fans. And if you're not working in kind of a hand-to-hand combat sort of manner, it's really hard.
Working with who?
Rights holders, certainly, influencers, fans themselves, and making sure that you're serving them the way they hope to be served. I mean, I worked at ESPN for 8 years, serving the fan all the time. In our case, it's also serving the rights holders, because they're also struggling to not only monetize their rights, but to grow their scale and sell tickets and sell sponsorships. Everything is fragmented. And so we look at it from my lens as we are a partner with those rights holders, not only on the live distribution. We're trying to change that conversation so that we're building media equity in those rights so that hopefully someday they outgrow Flow Sports and they could go to get that big broadcast deal. That'd be a win-win. So, you know, our North Star is how do we build these economies? And it's hard and increasingly hard.
I know you talked about your verticals, but how many live events do you have on your platform?
We have over 400,000 live competitions on the Flow Sports platform a year. And so we're doing a combination of producing a ton of them and taking feeds and coaching on increasing production quality. We've really grown our staff into a more professional. Joe Baker runs our production. He was 25 years ESPN veteran. Our new CMO is coming from Amazon. We brought in J.R. Donlin, who grew the WWE direct-to-consumer platform. So, you know, Flow Sports is probably the biggest sports media company that many have never heard of. And I think we're starting to evolve into something where, for the communities that we serve, through data and statistics and everything else, it's all about super serving them.
John, did you have a comment there on serving fans? I know that was a mantra that you had.
No, I was just nodding my head. This was what Mike was talking about.
Okay. So let's maybe John, you're probably the best person I can think of to answer this. So as you think about the RSN model a little bit, and we think about how some have had to fold, but some were able to revive themselves and continue to succeed. So what challenges are there for RSNs, and is there an opportunity for them to continue?
I think the RSN model is going away. That's hardly breaking news. One of the reasons is that when pay television got going, it was really led by local and regional cable companies, Comcast, Cox, Charter, etc. They had an investment in the community, and they helped set up a model not dissimilar to ESPN for local coverage of teams. You'd have all the 76er Flyer and Phillies games all put together in a package, and it was part of the community. When the virtual MVPDs launched, YouTube TV, Sling, Fubo, etc., their point of view is, we don't have to do truck rolls. We don't have to have equipment in your house. What we need from sports is more national in presence. So they felt if we could have ESPN, TNT, FS1, we're fine. And they began, this is Sling as well, they began to drop the RSNs. And the whole arithmetic for RSN, similar to ESPN, worked on having all that distribution so you could have the affiliate fees plus the advertising. Once the digital MVPDs began to pull out, it was like a pinprick in the industry. And the internet has kind of made that model like, well, why? Why can't, fans don't understand, why can't I see every game? So the money is running out of the RSN system. In many cases, it's still a better deal for teams than putting their games on local TV stations or doing direct to consumer. But Diamond Sports is in bankruptcy. Warner Brothers Discovery has gotten out of the business. Comcast still has a few regionals. It remains an okay business in large markets like this one in New York City, where there's just so many people and you can get to your Mets and Yankees fans. But I believe it's a form that's going away. The NBA, because the NBA's new national TV agreements are only being negotiated now. Mm-hmm. They're not settled. Baseball and hockey and the other RSN sports, they have their national TV deals in place through 2028. The NBA has flexibility to do something different if they so choose. One of the options you could see when those new deals start in 25, 26 is just more games available nationally, or a bifurcation where games are available both in terms of streaming and in terms of linear TV, changing the nature of exclusivity. So the RSNs were terrific businesses and served a role for a long, long time. They're in trouble now.
So and Marty, maybe you can speak on this, is there a path forward with a direct-to-consumer product for the RSNs?
It's interesting. You see a lot of experimentation happening, but it's difficult. Like, running a direct-to-consumer business is not for the faint of heart. Chasing subscribers every week, every day is not, and retaining them over time is not an easy endeavor to have. At the same time, you're also balancing growing audience, and so you want to reach as many fans as possible, but you have a paywall between you and that subscriber that gets back to an equivalency on lifetime value of those fans, or an ARPU that's equivalent, is a really tough thing to work through. And so we see a lot of experimentation. We see a lot of on the fan engagement side, it's all about what's your data strategy? How are you connecting that data back up from the streaming back into your ticketing system, into your merchandise system, into your other ways to really understand kind of that 360 degree view. And some teams underestimate how hard doing data in a good privacy compliant way can be. And so you have to really lean in on those types of things. So I don't know, it's gonna be a fascinating space to watch, because there's no single, it's really hard to pinpoint a single answer that says, hey, for the rest of those games that are not tied up in my national TV deals, what are we gonna do to reach as many fans as possible and at the same time maximize that revenue across those fans? And so, you know, as a technology provider, your only option then is just to be flexible. You just have to bend with whatever direction the wind is going for those customers that are going to try that next experiment, that are going to try that next service, that are going to, you know, do something different with their data. You have to have that flexibility built into the platform.
Does that flexibility include a better fan experience through streaming, right? Is that what they're experimenting in?
Absolutely. You know, it's funny how many teams we talk to, you know, I think Amazon Prime is kind of setting a bar of their Thursday night experience, four screens, all simultaneous, all in 4K, all synchronized to the frame. That's really hard to do, actually, in a lossy environment that the internet is, right? And so you've got multiple announcers talking over on each different tracks. You have multiple stats actually coming in real time, their real time stats. And so that is Amazon, and they have the money to do that. And then you talk to different teams, and they're like, I want that. And you're like, well, you know, I'm not sure that's in your budget. But, you know, let's find a detente where, again, we can engage our fans, we can harvest the data to use in a more holistic way across that base, and at the same time fit within the business model that is available to that team or that club at the time, and, you know, given their other rights deals. It's a rocky set of shoals to kind of navigate as a ship. So
Mike, I think this might be a softball question for you, but do sports or do streaming services, do they need major sports rights to be successful? Softball question, because I'm thinking about
it's not a softball question, because it's wildly complex.
Okay.
Right? Because I think we're getting into a place with the streaming where you have to consider shareholder value when you're a Disney or a Comcast or whatever. And what Amazon's doing, I think what's unknown, and it's a beautiful product, is it scalable? I don't think anybody knows. Is that scalable for anything below the NFL? Is it scalable for Major League Baseball or the NHL or Major League Soccer with what Apple's doing? The data isn't available for any of us to really understand that. So for shareholder value, yeah, I think you need tier 1A sports rights. Where I sit, typically, is with a little bit of fear, because you know this direct-to-consumer stuff is really hard. The technology, no different than satellite or even broadband, continues to be an evolution. I have fear for the tier 2, tier 3, tier 4 rights holders. Where are they going to go? And I think the conversations that isn't happening in mainstream sports media coverage is an issue of survival. How are these second-tier rights holders, anything below Power 5 in the NCAA landscape, they've paid for these unbelievable venues, and yet their media rights very well may dry up in a day when ESPN goes to direct-to-consumer. Is there value anymore for those tier 2 and tier 3 rights? That's the world that I sit in today, and it's like, how do we build those economies?
Pac-12 was top of five.
Okay. Great. Yes. And they couldn't get the media rights deal. Right.
Yeah, I was going to say, Johnny, bring that up. What does that mean? Like, what happens?
I mean, just to Mike's point, you're going to start seeing stuff you haven't seen before. The Pac-12 imploded over a weekend. My alma mater, Stanford, is going to play in the Atlantic Coast Conference. So these are not, you know, these are not normal occurrences that you would see. And to where we started, you had the best of all possible business models. My former boss, John Skipper, used to say to certain employees that they were in their office aggressively watching the phone. And we have had an industry that's been in this office aggressively watching the phone for a long time. And it's not possible anymore. Everyone's going to have to work much, much harder. and there's less money to go around. You know, if you look at the last set of negotiations, the NFL, in addition to Amazon, the NFL is taking still more money out of the system where there's less money in the system. So what does that mean? Well, that means, as Mike laid out, the squeeze is coming.
And then to add a further element, you know, if there aren't distributors willing to pay a rights fee for that content, distribution of that content then becomes a cost going forward. Just getting your content out in order to sell advertising against, sponsorship, merchandise, is now a cost today, where 5 years ago it likely was not, because the sports media ecosystem was frothing at the opportunity to just put more and more content into the cable bundle. It's gone.
And now the fragmentation of those sports rights is a challenge for the fan experience.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
So not to shift gears a little bit, but thinking about that fan experience, and from your perspective, maybe, what is coming? What do you think is coming in terms of the fan experience? Maybe not just in the arena, but in viewing sports and viewing sports content.
I'll be honest, it's really hard to say. I wish I had a crystal ball, right? I worked at Fox Sports 18 years ago, and you know, John said it best, 10 years ago, right? The meeting that you were in and what they heard about Netflix. It's going to just continue to evolve. It's going to continue to evolve, in my opinion, quicker. I know, you know, with AI is going to play a big part. The evolution there is happening. I think, you know, consumers want options, so that's definitely going to be a continued, where you find your sports content, your team. I think. Again, it goes back to, I talk a lot about, you know, reaching young audiences. There has to be a shift there with the leagues, right? And I worked actually at Snap before the Rams, and the league partnerships that they built at Snapchat and that audience, that the leagues were the engagement, the younger millennial and Gen Z generation that they were reaching was so massive. And how do you continue to do that in a meaningful way? And because it's a matter of where fans want to consume. And so that's ultimately, I don't have a straight answer.
Right,
I want to say it's not going to be fragmented, but I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon.
Well, maybe we approach it this way, Megan, thinking about your clients, or the clients that use your platform. When they come to you thinking about a better experience for their consumers, what does that interactivity look like? What are they looking for?
I think that a unified experience is something that everybody's been asking for at Endeavor Streaming. So you have folks that are watching the games on one streaming app, you're buying tickets on a different streaming app, you are betting on another one, and then maybe some sort of interactivity with a different. So putting all of that together and making it a destination for people to be able to go to, I think, like, it's been tried by at least one team, but I don't think it's been a universal thing that's happened at this point. So being able to engage with the fan and have that community.
There's always this conversation about being able to watch and bet, right? So I'm watching a live event and I'm betting, and there was lag issues that consumers were concerned about. Well, am I behind the live bet? Are we at a point, Marty, where that's not an issue anymore?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a combination there. The technology has effectively been solved, but maybe not at scale. So most sports betting actually, when you go global, actually happens in-game or in-match, basically. So it's all incremental, a lot of prop bets, or who's going to, you know, score the next goal, et cetera, you know, that kind of thing. Is built into it. The technology itself, we can get to low latency, which is kind of broadcast equivalency, so 3 to 10 seconds behind the actual screen. That actually works pretty well today, and that can work at scale. It does have challenges, though, when you fold in advertising relative to it. So you have to be a property that can sell most of your own ads when you go out into a programmatic world, and those ad servers, while they make a decision about which ad to give you, pick a second. You don't have a second in that 3 second, you know, in that 5 second window. So there's challenges there, again, of the technology all works, the synchronization of the stream and the vets, and the actually works with the same stacks, actually the same synchronized key points that sit behind the actual stream. So that stuff works, but there's a real question about, could it work at scale to some of the events we do, our millions of concurrent viewers? And there's a real question on the technology yet about, can you get all of that together at that level of scale? But on smaller events on Victoria harness racing for horse break for them, given their audience of tens of thousands of viewers for any given race, that kind of scale. So we're getting there, we're working on it.
So, I mean, I think the two things that, you know, I hope are being solved, and you guys are clearly the experts in it, but to think about the ability to watch and bet on major sports events, and then thinking about the discovery process of finding the game you want to watch, right? We hear lots of fans say, I don't even know what channel the baseball game's on. I don't know if it's on a streaming service. I don't know if it's on at 11:30 in the morning. I don't know if it's on Peacock or, you know, Apple TV. So sort of thinking about that discovery process or the challenge for the fan to find the content. Is there, you know, there was a report that came out that ESPN was potentially building a all-encompassing aggregator to be able to do that. Is that something that you think could happen, John?
Oh, yeah. I think multiple entities are going to try to solve that, whether it's Apple or Google or Amazon. There'll be the creation of some sort of affiliate model where if you get a call-out for a game on the home screen of your phone, Android or iOS, and you go and watch it, the entity can then get a fee for it, but
like a shared revenue.
Yeah, concept. But of course it's not ideal, right? I have a friend who's an Arsenal fan who told me that he has to subscribe to 7 different services today in order to see every Arsenal game, which makes no sense. So I believe that rebundling is coming at some point. It's not going to be as elegant as what we've seen in the cable bundle, as what we've seen in the pay TV bundle. Also, just choices coming. Marty talked about how Amazon has put their NFL feed together. There are lots of different services that fans want, the multi-screen that YouTube TV now has with NFL Sunday Ticket. There's a great service that WSC does called Catch Up Highlights, which is also on YouTube TV, where you have a choice between joining game live or seeing the best plays before you join in. More and more of these things are going to come. I'm a big New York Giants football fan, unfortunately. And it's shocking to me that in 2023, I can't watch the game with a New York Giants oriented announcing. I get whoever Fox or CBS or NBC assigns, and they're perfectly good, but I want the choice to watch a group that has a domain expertise,
sure,
and long-term with the club. I think that kind of stuff is going to happen.
The personalization.
Yeah, increasingly.
My question for you, there was the potential shift where ESPN, Disney, and Charter, right? Comcast and Charter did a deal where they were going to take the ability to now, we're leading to the direct-to-consumer conversation, right, of ESPN. But the idea was that ESPN was getting a specific rights fee from Charter, and then Charter came back and said, well, we can't necessarily pay you that if we don't have access to all of your content, right? So I think it was sort of a groundbreaking deal that could set the industry in a different direction, but I'd like to get your thoughts on something like that.
I absolutely agree, and I do think that it is the first domino to fall in a move to continue to unbundle the cable bundle. You know, how they execute it, what the price point looks like, and how they ultimately distribute it to the marketplace, I think is an open question. It continues down this path where we were in a conversation earlier where, you know, how are you going to serve fans in the future? And I think that you will it'll mirror society, right? There's going to be a segment of fans that is absolutely super served. NFL fans have no lack of optionality in terms of understanding the context or why they care. Whether you get a New York Giants announcer or not, there's unlimited New York Giants coverage out there. My question will be, as the importance of the Tier 1A continues to grow and the monetization of that Tier 1A continues to grow, what next? I don't know that anybody's necessarily proven or laid out how this all becomes profitable. ESPN's been an absolute juggernaut of profitability for Disney. I haven't seen the math yet on Amazon, on Apple, on ESPN, on any of these guys as to when they are going to fundamentally have a profitable business that enables them to sustain these enormous billion-dollar plus rights fees in perpetuity. And I think the world is challenged there without a whole lot of answers.
So that brought up a thought that I think was on a panel that we discussed earlier, or the idea, or maybe it was a conversation I was having on the side, I can't remember. But anyway, the idea that could there potentially be a time where a consumer can buy an individual event on an a la carte basis, right? So I want to pay 99 cents to watch the, now maybe it's probably more than 99 cents, but to watch the Rams game, right? And I just want that game. Yeah. Do we think that there's a potential where that becomes the fan experience, an a la carte model on individual games?
My point of view is that it'll be tested, right? There will be, I think the NBA has already tested
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you can buy Knicks games today for like $9.99.
Yeah.
Too much.
but to that point, I don't think it's scalable, right? Because at that level, you want the production quality and the optionality to continue to increase. All of that has cost, right? And so I think in a world that we're going to live in, and why you believe there's going to be a rebundle, and I tend to agree, is that you have to have sustained subscribers. You have to, I think I saw something that ESPN's ARPU was like $6 a subscriber. That is fundamentally too low.
Yeah.
It has to get to like 30. And I think that is going to be the differentiator. And so doing that 99 cent a game thing, you have to remarket to that customer every single game to get them back. Again, back to the scale topic, that doesn't scale. That's just more cost. So how much money are you going to make off that 99 cent or that $9.99? It could be like negligible. It's a lot of work for not much profit.
Any other thoughts on that? The idea of going to individual per game?
I think it makes no sense. I agree. It'll be tested, but it's going to be an unsuccessful test.
Do you have a thought on that?
I think it really depends on the sport and the federation. So for Tier 1, makes no sense. They can get better monetization somewhere else. But when you get down, Tier 2s, Tier 3s, other sports federations, again, looking to engage a fan, what we would say is that transaction gives you a right to contact that person as a follow-up. And so if I can do that and even break even as an acquisition tool for to acquire those fans, and I'm a Tier 2 lead in some, part of the world, it might be the best acquisition tool that's out there to get them engaged, and then you follow up afterwards.
But in that case, wouldn't you just say, subscribe to this thing, here's your free trial, it starts at $9.99 or whatever, after 30 days, would you, rather than say, okay, would you like to buy this one game?
Yeah, it turns out that free trials never quite work in sports. Because people jump in for that one particular game, and then they'll jump back in a week later on an abc123@yahoo.com mail address, and so they just kind of rotate through, and so it's actually better to charge up front to get that actual paying relationship with them, that credit card. It qualifies them in, basically. So there was a lot of trials on that, especially like South America actually did a lot of it. They 2016, 2015, right around, soccer matches, football matches, and things like that, and they quickly disabused themselves of that idea. So
we did actually get our poll question to work, so I appreciate all of you who have participated in it. Same topic. I mean, I'm just looking at the results here, but if you have not taken the poll, the idea is that you would send in code, the code related to that. So this is the first time we've done it and we've gotten it to work today. So we appreciate all of you participating. I wanted to see if it actually works. But the next sort of topic that I wanted to move on to is thinking about the rebundling or the sports tier package that is now starting to happen, right? Where you can, if you think about it, in the traditional cable TV model, I could add my basic cable, I could add the movies, and then I could add my sports package. Now we're starting to see that reappear in streaming services. Is that the model that we're heading towards, to be able to get your sports content? And I open that up to anybody who wants to try to address that concept.
I mean, I think it makes sense for the DVD operators that are out there relative to their overall price points that they're paying for this content. These rates are expensive. And so super serving a specific segment of your customer base that wants to jump into that premier theater makes sense. But again, what we're talking about is a fracturing of my ability as a consumer to track down where that particular event is. Do I always subscribe to a premium theater? In my pay TV offering, that's an easy thing to do, probably for older demographics that we're targeting. If we're going after younger demographics, I'm not so sure that that's going to be the best model that's out there. So,
will we end up though with, I'm very similar to your cable package, where consumers sort of decided, look, for example, if you're not a sports fan, why am I paying for ESPN? I don't watch it. Right? Now we're seeing the flip side of that. If I now have to get a sports tier package, with, let's say they charge me $30 a month for the sports tier package on my streaming service, but I only watch two of those channels. Right? Is that what's going to happen?
I just think tiers have never worked for sports. You're going to get back to some elements of rebundling. You might get to usage-based subscriptions where you're subscribing and you're actually paying on what you use. So, if you're just not watching, If Max is in a package, but you're not watching Max, you're subscribed, you're not paying them because you're not watching them. It could be that we get to that. The way that it's headed at the moment is not really going to work for anybody, and I believe that fans are going to get increasingly frustrated. And they're frustrated at a time where you have an unlimited supply of free, ad-supported, short-form video networks like TikTok and Instagram and YouTube Shorts that are perfectly plausible way for people to spend their time. So if you don't package premium content, whether it's sports or others, in a way that gets people to subscribe and sustain those subscriptions, you just might lose them to something else.
Yeah, I mean, just to take my personal experience, right? I was watching a game, told my son, I said, did you see the game? He's like, yeah, I watched the highlight. Right? So when we think about that consumer engagement in the younger generation, what's happening to your point, John, is the consumption of that is happening on mobile, maybe not necessarily the live broadcast, but they're still getting that content, and they're not paying for it.
Right.
So I think is that a challenge for the industry?
It's a massive challenge. I think in our experience, it's you bundle around passions, right? I think I was listening earlier that a bundle around food or a bundle around films. In our case, the user behavior is you bundle around a specific sport. The average fan out there can really only follow two sports at a time. And so, even bundling 15 different sports together in the flow model where we have 20 different verticals, the user behavior doesn't watch everything. The user behavior goes to what they're passionate about. And so you want to bundle the like content in such a way that it is easy to spend money. Everybody wants to buy the thing that's as close to free as possible, but that is unscalable. And before you know it, if fans don't embrace the reality that you have to pay for premium product, the product will disappear, Pac-12.
Yeah.
And so in our lens, we're trying to bundle like content together. And I did a deal recently with a professional baseball league. And his owners wanted to just distribute for free, but they couldn't afford the production to distribute for free. And I was offering him a rights fee. And his comment, which stuck with me, is if somebody's trying to throw money at you, don't duck. These leagues can't afford to duck when money is being thrown at them. Otherwise, they may cease to survive. And I don't know when that gets to a place where it scales up to kind of that tier one stuff. But if it can happen to the Pac-12, how many years is the Pac-12 around?
Like over 100.
This is a real thing. And so 99-cent pay-per-views or $9 pay-per-views or just watching highlights freely available for free without a mechanism to go pay for that premium content is a real negativity for the sports media ecosystem.
Marty, you're going to say
something. It feels a lot like it's 2003 and we're in the music business where, everybody's holding on to the old business models and with our fingernails we're clamping onto it and we're trying to figure it out. And it really feels like we need to go through a trough, and now the music business is bigger than it ever was with CDs. But it was getting through that whole cycle to reinvent what music meant and how people, how the monetization would all shake out. And musicians had to recognize that, touring was going to be their primary income source instead of CDs. And all of that, it feels very pattern-like for sports right now. And I don't know where it's going to end up, but it does feel like we've got a trough to work our way through on the monetization for sports at large. Premium leagues with big fan bases, they're going to be fine. But, it's going to be an interesting transition in the next 5-10 years before we get to the other side of it. And it's going to be bigger and better for consumers is what I would predict on the other side of that. But it's going to be painful to get from here to there.
So we're down to about 3 minutes left in our panel. You actually jumped into my very last question, which is in 5 years, what are we going to see? So maybe, quickly, 5 years in the sports media landscape, what do you think we'll see?
I mean, I think I've said it before, but I think the unified experience, so being able to do all things in one place and really reaching the younger generation by having more interactivity within that service. So it's not just a feedback experience, it's actually engaging and having community, because that's what the younger generation does now. Like, they're multitasking and they're chatting with their friends and they might have somebody right next to them that they're online doing it, right? So I think it's going to be an experience that I hope will reach the younger generation to keep them going into the sports vertical.
Mike, your thoughts, 5 years from now, sports landscape?
I expect a huge movement in the merger and acquisition world, a consolidation of media distributors to get closer to that experience, but that doesn't happen without a nuance on the bundle. The companies have to come together.
I mean, I think before I get to John and then Michelle, I think a lot of this plays into the rights deals that are existing, right? Maybe it's not 5 years, maybe it's 10 years when the NFL rights deal is up with the traditional broadcasters, right? So, I mean, I think we could talk 5 years, we could talk 10 years, but I don't know, John, your thoughts on 5, maybe 10?
I think you're going to see the creation of new short-form rights products that will be heavily personalized, and just as the panelists have said, we'll figure out something that you want to pay for, but are going to be a shorter experience. I'm happy to sit on my couch for 3 hours and watch a football game, but my children aren't, right. And I don't think that they're the exception anymore.
How about you?
I think we'll see options. My 9-year-old will sit and watch the entire game. Sets his alarm to watch the 6:30 international game.
God bless him.
Yeah.
My 7-year-old wants to watch the highlights.
Right.
So I think it's having options. I think there will be a consolidation with the media capacity, I personally think. But I think fans and users want options. They want to be able to watch where they want, how they want, when they want.
So we have about 2 minutes here for questions. If we have, and we'll start. We're probably not going to get to all of them, but we'll start up here in the front.
You talked a lot about pay-per-view and loss, but really the one that does that is Megan's company. They've been doing, UFC's been doing it for, what, 1,000 years now?
So, 1,000 years of UFC.
Well,
and WWE, right? So they've been doing pay-per-views for a long time and have managed to do okay, right? TPO, we have a nice IPO, all that. So are there lessons there that other sports can take from the way that you all do that and monetize that in this future that we're talking about?
Yeah. Well, I definitely think with a premium event that UFC has been able to capture, that pay-per-view, everybody's accessing successful. But even the UFC now has Fight Pass, which is a 24/7 streaming service. And so you can go in and watch, you know, a fight from Madison Square Garden from last Friday, which I did yesterday, and I just fast forward to all the interesting parts. But I think that it depends on what the sport is, but there's definitely a business model for very specific use cases where you're going to get people that have a disposable income that also want like an experience, right? Because oftentimes you're going to a bar, you are paying for it, and your friends are coming over. So you've got to kind of have that piece of it as well, I think, to be successful long term. And it's a model that you don't have to go out every single time and try to re-engage the fan, like with the 99 cent, because it's usually a captive audience that already knows it's happening. But it is an interesting concept.
So I do want to just mention the poll for those of you who took it, which really tells us that consumers want choice. One more question right here, and then we are out
of it. Hi, thanks for your time, everyone. My name is Shane. I'm from Peacock. My question is about piracy. It hasn't been discussed in this panel. I'm curious what your perspective is on, I guess, the role that piracy plays in how sports media rights are going to evolve, how consolidation will ensue in the next 5 to 10 years.
I was going to say, and we didn't bring it up, but piracy and artificial intelligence are going to be bigger and bigger problems. As you move to streaming, piracy is already a ginormous problem. It's bigger for pay-per-views, typically, than for seasonal sports. But recently, when you had the Fury Nagano fight, I went on to Twitter, and my whole feed was just pirated streams being offered. And so that's gonna have to get cleaned up. I don't know if we'll ultimately get to like some sort of blockchain video verified stream and everything else is gonna get blocked or whatever, but strikes me that the industry is gonna have to get much, much more serious about it over the next 10 years because it's now gonna hit their direct-to-consumer businesses.
That's where I think there's gonna be some interesting dynamics. I believe it's Apple, who's been really bullish on global rights. When you fragment geographically your rights, you are inviting increased piracy, right. Increased VPN. You know, we do the Tour de France exclusively in Canada, and we get crushed on piracy, just absolutely crushed.
It's like whack-a-mole, right?
It truly is. And then in our case, you can, when we try to police it, inevitably we take down a stream on YouTube that we didn't intend to take down, and you struck that down, and it creates another legal matter. It is truly whackable. So, you know, we didn't really talk about it, but I think the trend for the desire for global rights is a way to kind of help you manage the inventory in such a way that you can have a little more control. But technology just isn't there yet.
Well, I would like to take more questions. We could probably spend another 2 hours on this topic. So I really want to please give our panelists a round of applause. Thank you all for coming. We appreciate you being here. And that's all the time we have coming up at 11:30. We do have the keynote with Hallmark Media, so please stick around for that. Also, I want to mention, you guys can go, sorry. Find a way out. No. Yeah. But,